like to convene this meeting of the Senate Committee on Healthcare. The chair is testifying in another committee, so I have the gavel. Unfortunately, I don't have work sessions on any bills I like, so we'll just have to go with what it is. So I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 485.
Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee, before you is Senate Bill 485, brought to you by Senator Prozansky at the request of Orchard Health. The measure would exempt for-profit and non-profit businesses that provide palliative care or majority medical services through a rural health clinic from current Oregon law, requiring physician ownership among entities created for the purpose of practicing medicine. The bill specifies that for-profit exemption only would apply to business entities that derive 50% or more of their revenue from providing medical services to individuals that reside in a health professional shortage area, a medically underserved area, or a medically disadvantaged area. The measure has no revenue or fiscal impact statements issued yet. There is a subsequent referral to business and transportation on this.
Okay. Thank you. Senator.
Senator Cruz, Vice Chair Senator Cruz, and committee members. My name is Floyd Prozansky, State Senator for District 4, which includes parts of Lane and Douglas counties. Senate Bill 485 represents an opportunity for us to assist in rural health care. Oliver Alexander, who will be speaking on behalf of his organization, Orchid Health, will give you the presentation as to why this is important and critical. We've actually had this bill before the legislature previously. They've done a lot of, I'm going to say, homework to try to bring people together and fully appreciate and understand what services they provide and how they actually are very integrated into the rural health care. And if you have not had a chance, I believe up on OLIS, should be a letter in support also from Congressman DeFazio that's dated February 3rd. Without going through that letter, I will just say that he also recognizes the importance of having organizations such as Orchid Health coming forward. Orchid Health is actually located within my district in Oak Ridge. And I've spoken to the mayor as well as other individuals within the community, and they have kept on talking. They keep talking about how important it is to be able to have health care immediately for their residents and in the surrounding areas close to home and not actually needing to be transported or drive themselves into, quote unquote, the metro area of Eugene Springfield. I will tell you that it is ironic that we do have a transportation service that runs Monday through Friday called Diamond Express. It is a service that's subsidized on federal grants through LTD as well, that does in fact provide for individuals to be able to make trips into Eugene Springfield, but it's very limited in scope. And the reality, it's very time consuming. So it's very important from my perspective, from the citizens I represent in the Oak Ridge West Fur area, for them to have access as quick as possible to medical care. And this is medical care that's more on the preventive model as much as it is for an acute care or urgency type of matter. So with that, Mr. Vice Chair, I will turn it over to Oliver Alexander. I also will ask for the permission to leave so I can carry on to my other committee that I'm stepped out of.
Yeah. Senator, that would be fine. And as you remember, at one point in time, I represented that area, so I'm very familiar with the subject.
That's correct. Thank you.
Hello, Vice Chair Cruz and members of the committee. My name is Oliver Alexander, and I'm co-founder of Orchid Health. Orchid is a company that provides quality-focused health care to rural Oregonians. And Orchid was founded on the principle that there are 650,000 rural Oregonians, and 130,000 of them lack local health care access. With this severe shortage of access in mind, we formed our business that seeks to provide physical, mental, and eventually dental care as well to rural Oregonians through small clinics located in rural towns. And our vision is and will continue to be creating healthy communities. That's really what it's all about for us, and that's how we operate today. Since our opening in Oak Ridge in 2014 and recently our opening in Estacada in 2016, we've grown to manage over 2,000 patients, 70% of which are on the Oregon Health Plan. As a rural focused provider. We're very proud to be on the front line, if you will, of Oregon's healthcare, and we're very proud to handle some of Oregon's most difficult patients. For instance, in the last 2 weeks at our Estacada location, we've provided some extremely intensive care that's not unusual. We had an adolescent show up on our door who required over 60 stitches, which we provided, and unfortunately, it wasn't from an accident or anything. They were entirely self-inflicted, so we were able to help get that patient into inpatient psychiatric facility the same day. We had another patient the next day who was chronically unmanaged with their diabetes. Their mid-20s, they'd already had complete parts of their foot removed, not just toes, due to the lack of care services available locally. So we're very proud to take on the hardest patients and serve rural Oregon. However, we're consistently impeded by ORS 58.375. The current law states that in order to provide medical services, you must be majority owned and directed by a licensed Oregonian physician. Our company currently complies with this law, but our physician owner is minimally involved and therefore unwilling to sign for financing that our business needs on a regular basis. This consistently impacts us and, more importantly, impacts our patients. When we opened in Oak Ridge, our goal was to have an x-ray on site and be the first x-ray within a 45-minute radius for our patients. There's a $70,000 machine. We couldn't get financing and we couldn't afford to pay for it, so Oak Ridge still does not have an x-ray. Additionally, we have made quite a name for ourselves in the rural healthcare community, and we consistently have people applying to work and join our company and serve our mission. Just last year, we had an expanded practice dental hygienist who is ready to work for us full-time, but at $45 an hour with a dental suite and additional renovation costs, we couldn't afford any of that to finance the additional services that our patients desperately need. Oak Ridge has no dental services locally, and Estacada's dental situation is similar. So to solve the problems with 58.375, we propose some very narrow changes to the current law. Specifically, the changes outlined are just for companies serving rural Oregon, and they're just for companies that operate federally certified rural health clinics. And as well, we've included wording that states in order to satisfy this requirement, there has to be a bylaw in a business's a bylaw that states the business must not influence any physician or provider medical decision making. So we ask that you continue to support rural Oregonians and small business and work with us to create healthy communities by making a change here.
Question, Senator?
Well, it's more comment, Mr. Chair. I've been on this committee when you brought this bill before, and I've been a little dubious. I'm not dubious anymore. I think this is a really good idea. I think you've proven what you're doing, and you're doing it the right way, and I admire the work that you guys have done. And this law was put into place to avoid undue influence on healthcare providers, but frankly, there are so many outside influences that affect practice patterns now that I think it's outdated and archaic, and it is a barrier to providing innovative methods of care and sources of care. So I'm really supportive, and I appreciate the work that you've done.
Thank you, Senator.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you. And can I make a quick response there?
Yes, you may.
So we actually ran some data based on a study, and so out of 51 states, including the District of Columbia, 25 of them have no corporate practice of medicine legislation. So it is indeed outdated, in my opinion. And of the states that do have legislation, it averages about 33 years old. So in today's value-based healthcare system, we think it's quite irrelevant. But again, we're focusing just on expanding Oregon's rural access because it is the highest need population. So, thank you, members of the committee.
Thank you, Mark Bonaro.
Thank you, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee. My name is Mark Bonanno. I'm General Counsel for the Oregon Medical Association. You have our written testimony already, and I'll just highlight 3 points from that and then respond to any questions that you may have. The first is that Senate Bill 485 seeks to amend a longstanding principle in Oregon that says that business interests shouldn't trump physician and patient interests with respect to delivery of healthcare services. The second is that The way 485 attempts to do that is to create some new exceptions that are a little unclear. They're not as clear as the one for federally qualified health centers. We support that. Federally qualified health centers and the oversight that that exception represents. Third and final, the creation of a new 50% rule for for-profit corporations to engage in the practice of medicine under 58375 without any licensed Oregon physician, either as a stakeholder or a fiduciary manager of that business, and without any effective oversight by any Oregon agency, as far as we can tell, the way 485 is structured, would be a departure from a longstanding principle in Oregon that says physicians practice medicine, not corporations. So in closing, we don't believe this is the right statute and vehicle to do this. If Oregon wants to create a vehicle to deliver health care in a different way, we think a new statute should be created that takes into account the various interests of all the stakeholders and that does so without having business interests, trump licensee interests here in the state of Oregon. With that, I'll pause for questions.
Any questions?
You don't want to get me started.
Okay. No questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Senator Beyer.
No other people?
That's it.
That's it. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to say that I'm really very supportive of this. I've watched the development of this group kind of spinning out of the University of Oregon in Oak Ridge. And they're doing an excellent job. The people in Oak Ridge are very happy that they have medical provisions right there. It's, you know, it's 40-some miles from Eugene, long way on a tough road to get care. And they're doing a great job. And they're not stepping in the middle of the medical practice. They're providing an opportunity for the services to be provided. And they're doing the same thing up north in the Clackamas County area as well. So I think they're doing a good thing. I spent 10 years on Mackenzie Willamette Hospital Board when it was a community-based hospital, and we had clinics up there in other places and always had a hard time running them, making that work. And I think they're doing, frankly, a much better job than we did back then, more efficiently and cheaper. So it makes a lot of sense. In terms of the private versus corporate, I mean, if you really look at the way family medicine is being provided today, almost all of it is being provided in clinics that are under professional management, and most of the physicians working there are working there on an hourly basis. They're not managing it. It's really the same thing. There's really no difference in the way it's being provided. So I don't see that as a problem. And in fact, two of our hospitals in Oregon are owned by private out-of-state corporations. In fact, the one I used to be on the board of is there. And they're doing a fine job. That does not seem to be an impediment. It makes sense. If this is the way that we can get good quality medical services out in the rural areas, I think it's the thing we ought to do.
Further discussion. I would like to have the Oregon Medical Board look at the bill to see are there anything about it that you absolutely could maybe change to make it more palatable to the board. Many of us would like to see this go forward, but we want to make sure that we take into account some of the egregious errors or concerns that the Oregon Medical Board had. I meant the Oregon Medical Association has. Yeah, sorry. Thank you. All right. Any other discussion? With that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 485 and open a work session on possible introduction of committee measures.
Madam Chair, I move that LC 1682 dated 9/29/16 be introduced as a committee bill.
Vice Chair Cruz moves that the LC 1682 dated 9/29/16 be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered. Close the work session on introduction of committee measures and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 423. Mr. Droppers, can you bring us up to date on that? 423.
Yeah, 423.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 423 is brought to you by Senator Senator Hayward at the request of Zoom Care. The measure would allow physician assistants to dispense Schedules 3 and 4 drugs under the Federal Controlled Substances Act. There are no amendments and testimonies available on all this.
All right. We have who's first? Okay. Lynn Bernstein, Dr. Albert DePerio, and Larry Cartier.
Chair Mortis Anderson and members of the committee, my name is Len Bergstein, and I'm here representing Zoom Plus Care in support of Senate Bill 423. With me appearing is Dr. Albert DePiero, who is the co-founder of Zoom Plus Care and is also the medical director. Also with us is Larry Cartier, who's currently the head of the Zoom pharmacy operations, and Larry served with distinction as a long-term Oregon pharmacist, and he was a previous chair of the Oregon Board of Pharmacy. As your staff said, 423 is a modest but meaningful reform of state policy to allow physician assistants under strict supervision to dispense certain prescription medicines currently identified as Category 3 and 4 controlled substances, regardless of whether they provide that care in urban or rural settings. There are five really good reasons and objectives behind this bill. It clarifies certain ambiguities in the statutes. One of the statutes says they can't do it, and another says they can on certain circumstances. This bill would clarify that. It would create uniform dispensing practices for all physician assistants, and it would provide consumer convenience. We think it also will improve patient outcomes through complete care and ensure safety in dispensing, reporting, and storage of these medications, as you'll hear in just a moment. We've discussed this with the Oregon Medical Board and the Oregon Board of Pharmacy, and they both agree that this is something that they can't do by administrative rule. They really think that this has to be clarified and cured by statute, so that's why we brought this to your committee for consideration and policy decision. We've also spoken with several of the stakeholders that are involved in this. Some strongly support this, and some are waiting to kind of hear the policy discussions that arise here. I'd like to have Albert DePiero and then Larry talk about this, and then we would be available if you have any questions. Thank you very much.
Hi, Chair Monis Anderson and members of the Healthcare Committee. Thank you so much for having us here today. I'm Albert DePiero. I'm co-founder and chief medical officer of Zoom, and I'm here to speak in support of Senate Bill 423. As Len mentioned, this bill would make modest changes to the statutes that I think though would be clinically very important. Briefly, Zoom Care is an integrated delivery system. We have 25 clinics in Oregon providing the full scope of medical care, including urgent care, primary care, specialty care. And Zoom's model is built on a concept of on-demand care in neighborhoods. One of our core principles is delivering complete care at the visit, and that's why we have been, since founding, dispensing medications at the clinics. Our complete care includes being open till 2 a.m. every day, and we really pioneered the use of the extensive use of physician assistants and nurse practitioners as the core backbone of providers delivering frontline care. The core principle that this change would enable would really let us and other clinics dispense medicines such as tramadol and sudafedrin, very basic medicines in primary and urgent care. Some of you may be interested in how we ensure the quality and safety of physician assistants in our practice. As Len mentioned, we've worked extensively with the Oregon Medical Board, and I think we have now really the best-in-class quality and safety monitoring program for physician assistants. We have a really a six-step process that I enumerated in my testimony, written testimony, but it includes very thorough clinical testing during the interviewing, recruiting, and onboarding process. We also have dedicated clinical support, which is a physician, an MD, on assigned to strictly be providing clinical support to the PAs during all open hours of the practice. We have a mandatory Zoom University, which is our clinical training center for PAs. They all must attend this every month. And we conduct one-on-one, one-hour meetings with each PA. The supervising physician meets with the PA to teach, review cases, and mentor. And we have extensive evidence-based protocols for all of the common conditions we see in those practices. And we have a vigorous peer review process for quality monitoring. Finally, I think it would be appropriate to just wonder if such a bill would allow potentially dangerous medicines to leak into the system. I think it's important to realize that Zoom Care, from its founding, has, in its urgent care practices, has never prescribed and does not prescribe or dispense opioids and benzodiazepines. So I think this would be a pretty modest change, allowing the dispensing of some very basic urgent care and primary care medicines. And so that's why I would like to urge your support for this Senate Bill 423. Thank you.
Oh, there's a question.
Should we wait till the...
Fine.
Let's do the panel and then have questions.
Okay. Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the Health Committee. My name is Larry Cartier. I am an Oregon pharmacist. I'm not going to mention how long, but it's been a long time. I'm here representing Zoom Plus Care to speak in support of Senate Bill 423. Under the current statute, dispensing privileges of certain controlled medications are granted to physicians' assistants based on their geographic location or population that they serve. They're not based on the physician's assistant's license or competence. 423 eliminates this geographic difference in practice standards. As a pharmacist at Zoom Plus Care, my focus is to ensure that therapeutic outcomes are improved with the appropriate use of medications. At Zoom Plus Care, we have many of the required medications available for dispensing at the time of the patient visit, and both Len and Dr. Pirro have addressed that. As a pharmacist, I also recognize that national statistics show that up to one-third of all prescriptions written by a healthcare provider are never filled. And this model really takes away some of those obstacles. This is an issue that it presents itself in the healthcare environment, and this is we have a potential solution. So those prescriptions are never filled. Could be the cost of the medication. I understand that's a big concern for some members of the committee, as well as patient confusion about the treatment, the inconvenience of having a prescription filled, and potentially other patient factors. It's working well in our model to have those medications, select number of those medications available at the time of care. Pharmacy staff at Zoom Care is also responsible to ensure that the medication is safe, the security, the storage conditions are in place, and that the general dispensing process meets both regulatory and Zoom Care standards. To ensure the patient's safety, medications at Zoom Care are stored at the required temperatures, are safe, secured, and the medication inventory is tightly controlled and monitored. Medications are stored in our clinics in locking medicine med cabinets, and both dispensing and prescribing practices are closely monitored. If granted permission to dispense a limited number of controlled substances in our clinics, all such controlled substances dispensings will be reported to the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program. I believe you have written testimony that indicates this is not the case. This is the case that we will report the prescription to the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program. And that is done through our dispensing software, which is very similar to what you would find in a pharmacy operation. And that reporting is done on a daily basis and would be done on a daily basis to the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program. Our goal is not to turn our clinics into pharmacies, but based on patient feedback, our efforts around complete care, having some of the required medications readily available at the time of their visit has been a key to patient satisfaction with our model. With the goal of improving patient care, patient convenience, patient compliance, which is especially important, and overall patient satisfaction, we are simply requesting that our urban-based physicians' assistants be allowed to have the same practice and dispensing standards in physicians as physicians' assistants in other parts of Oregon. I appreciate the opportunity to present this information.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Gentlemen, I guess the question, one of the concerns raised here is that if you will describe it as liberalizing the dispensing privilege, here runs counter to the current attempt to avoid, you know, overprescription of opiates. Can you address that?
Sure. Chair Mona Sanderson and Senator Beyer. Yes, no, I think we similarly share that concern. I would just go back and emphasize first, these are very basic medicines. The dispensing would be controlled. We would be dispensing unit packages, so we can control the number that are given out. And in the end, I think it's actually more controlled than writing prescriptions for these. We would have real-time visibility into what's being dispensed, and we as the organization can control how much is being dispensed. I think it would also be important to just acknowledge we would certainly work closely with the Board of Medicine and Board of Pharmacy and in helping structure the rules, and certainly could provide our experience of 11 years of having no prescriptions of opioids or other controlled substances.
By we, I assume you're referring to ZoomCare, your organization. Yeah. But if we change the law, how does that apply to other physician assistant practices, particularly those that are operating independently?
Yes, I think we would certainly work in the medical board, would be medical board, and the pharmacy board would be structuring the rules around that. And I think that's where the controls would have to be put in place.
Further comments?
I would just say I don't think these drugs are problematic at all. And this is a perfect, I mean, that's why I agreed to introduce the bill on their behalf. I think this is a perfectly reasonable change. And there, and I think the point about having more control over the prescriptions and not putting them out in public is a really good one, too. So these are not, they are drugs that can be abused, which is why they're still scheduled drugs. But this is not the context where we're likely to see that happen, and it's a barrier to care for people to have this done.
Madam Chair, to Senator Steiner Hayward, I think there's a big jump between 3 and 2.
There's a huge jump between 3 and 2. I mean, it's really, it sounds like it's just one number, and it's more like an order of magnitude, Senator. You're 100%
correct. I just wanted
correct.
To point that out.
Yeah, so. And that's why, I mean, if they'd said Schedule 2, I would have said no way, but they don't even prescribe Schedule 2s. So it's actually really great.
And for the public, let them know what Schedule 2
is. Schedule 2s are opiates like codeine or oxycodone or morphine or Dilaudid or any of those things, and also benzodiazepines like diazepam, clonazepam, Valium, Ativan, the kinds of things that people get people in real trouble. It doesn't mean that Schedule 3 and 4 drugs can't be dangerous, but pretty much any drug can be dangerous if you don't use it properly. And they're not talking about dispensing large quantities over extended periods of time. These are dealing with acute issues for patients.
Chairman Sanderson, to follow up on that, Larry, do you want to answer that question in terms of the scale of what we currently prescribe?
Yeah. Chairman Sanderson, maybe just some idea of the type of, in terms of the scope of practice and how much dispensing we actually do. The actual numbers based on an average day in an average clinic are 10 to 12 prescriptions a day. So we're not a huge dispenser, but we do provide the medications where it's appropriate for the patients, and we feel that that's in the best interest of the patients. This would give us another tool to enhance patient care and take care of patients right at the point of care.
Okay. All right.
Just curious, not being new to the healthcare committee, you'd reference the differences between PAs practicing in rural communities and urban communities. Can enlighten me a little bit about what the existing practice is and the difference?
Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Byer, on the attachment of my comments, I at least gave you a look at what the statutes are. They, interestingly enough, and for possibly some good reasons at that point, rural communities are given more leeway in what they dispense and less control over the dispensers. So that it's a kind of an irony there, whereas in the urban areas, they are limited in limited in what they can, in fact, dispense according to this statute. So I tried to lay out for you 677511, which is the general prohibition, and then 677515, which seems to kind of give a, you know,
I see it.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the time. Thank you.
Elizabeth Rimley and Bill Cross. Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, Elizabeth Remley here on behalf of the Oregon Society of Physician Assistants, which represents the physician assistants licensed in Oregon. We are supportive of Senate Bill 423. We did not help Zoom Care write it. We didn't know it existed until it dropped, but we are supportive of it. We think it will improve access to care, especially in the rural areas, as you pointed out, Senator Byer, and we're asking about. You have a letter on OLIS describing sort of our interest in this bill, and I'm also happy to answer any questions that you might have about how physician assistants do prescribing dispensing now or how their licenses work. I want to point out one thing to you, which is that in addition to all the layers of safety that the Zoom Care folks provided to you, the additional layer of safety is that in physician assistants licensing provisions, they cannot provide any health care service that has not been delegated to them by a supervising physician and is not supervised by that supervising physician. And so only PAs who have the training and the history with Schedule 3 and 4 drugs would be the ones doing these prescribing and dispensing practices. So if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Chair Mona Sanderson, committee members, I'm Bill Cross, and here today on behalf of the Oregon State Pharmacy Association and the Oregon Health System Pharmacists, Society of Health System Pharmacists, and we are opposed to the bill. We had issues in 2011 when the original legislation passed permitting physician assistants to dispense. We worked quite closely with Zoom Care at that time, and one of the reasons I think that the pharmacists felt a little better about the statute was the limitation in terms of what scheduled drugs they could dispense. And going to threes and fours is something they're not comfortable with. There are some opiates that are Schedule threes. There's a concern that they're not required to report to the PDMP, the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program. I need to verify that. But if not, that would be a hole in our efforts to try and regulate or, you know, identify issues with opiate abuse. We have reservations the way it's at least drafted, and unfortunately, because of some miscommunications, I didn't have the time to look at. I mean, I did look at the PDMP statute. It's a little unclear to me whether physician assistants are called out and would be required to if they did schedule threes and fours. They're certainly not required to now, but that's because they're not doing schedules.
Senator Steiner-Hayward.
I just was going to ask the Zoom Care folks, actually, right now, if your physicians dispense threes and fours, are they required to report to PDMP?
Mm-hmm. For the record, again, Larry Cartier with ZoomCare. Senator Steiner Haywood, currently we don't do any dispensing of Schedule 3s and 4s.
I see.
So all we're, again, asking for is in our urban clinics is to enjoy the same practice standards as exist in for PAs in the rural setting. So there's no dispensing. And maybe the difference, maybe we should explain the difference between, you know, the prescribing versus dispensing. All physician's assistants, regardless of location in the state, can prescribe Schedule 2s through 5s. But only in the rural areas can they actually dispense. So in our urban clinics, there's no dispensing currently of 3s or 4s, and therefore there is currently no provision to report to PDMP. Our software system that we use for the physician dispensing has that capability. And in Washington State, there is a requirement that Class 5s be reported, and that's being reported to the Washington PDMP. But state laws are different, and that's kind of where we are. So currently, we don't do any
So if that
dispensing.
Were to be specified in the statute, that the reporting would have to happen just in keeping with that any dispensing anywhere basically has to be kept consistent with the PDMP reporting requirements,
correct.
That wouldn't be a problem from your perspective.
That wouldn't be a problem at all, because we're going to do it regardless, because it's basically an automatic reporting that's done through our dispensing software.
Yeah, and one more, if I may, Madam Chair. Mr. Cross, I appreciate the concerns of your group. I really do, and I think it's very important to be really careful, and I think we should, if we do in fact pass this legislation, we should watch pretty carefully and request some data back within a fairly short period of time. I guess my question for you is this. I actually had personal experience with this. I went to urgent care a couple months ago and got a prescription at 9:30 at night and really had trouble getting it filled, and I wasn't going to be free during normal business hours basically for the next 3 days. And so I'm just, even in an urban environment like Salem, it's hard to get a 24-hour pharmacy. And so I'm just curious about your thoughts about how do we address the needs of patients who are getting these prescriptions. Because if they're seen in a hospital emergency department, they can dispense. But if they're seen in an outpatient setting, which is a little bit more cost efficient, and we wouldn't want someone going there for a sinus infection or, you know, an emergency department for a sinus infection. I'm not trying to be difficult. I'm just curious about your thoughts.
Madam Chair, Senator Steiner Hayward, my thoughts would be my personal thoughts, because I really haven't, the Pharmacists Coalition hasn't discussed that. I think, obviously, those prescribers, nurse practitioners, physicians, others that had been dispensing through their practice, was something that we were very comfortable with. The ZoomCare model came along, and frankly, we've been impressed with ZoomCare. I don't know how to compare it to some of the other urgent care centers, but my guess is probably many of them provide care to that same kind of level of standard. And Dr. Sanders has done a wonderful job of trying to elevate the standard of care that they are, the practices that they utilize, and we've worked pretty closely with as they've implemented their program. So to the degree that that model were replicated in other areas, my guess would be the pharmacists would be a lot more comfortable, and we just haven't had, I guess, that kind of conversation.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So would it be possible, would you be amenable to an amendment that clarifies that
oh,
the
sure.
PDMP
oh, yeah, absolutely.
Standards need to be the same?
Sure.
Yeah, okay.
Let my staff know if you need a note.
Okay.
Or
go
or
through
you want to go through
yes,
all of her?
Yes,
that's fine.
Good.
Just go through the committee. That's fine. Yeah.
All right. Any other discussion? All right. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 423 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 272. Mr. Joppers, would you go over what this bill does?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you is Senate Bill 272, brought to you by the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. The bill defines formulary for prescription drugs for individual, small, and group health plans licensed here in the state of Oregon. The bill creates a new requirement for insurance carriers regulated by the Oregon Department of Consumer and Business Services to provide a complete list of drugs covered by each health plan if the plan reimburses a member for prescription drugs. The bill would require carriers to make information on prescription drug formulary publicly available in electronically searchable format or via a toll-free number. It would require carriers to notify members of any changes to a formulary and indicate the average cost sharing for an individual. There is a dash one amendment available on OLIS, and all testimony is also available on OLIS.
Lauren Sant, Christopher Friend, and Dale Turner, and then after them, Dan Monzer and Chris Bonoff.
Thank you, Chair Mona Sanderson and the committee. Caring Ambassadors Program. This is Lauren Sant with the Caring Ambassadors Program. We're a nonprofit organization and based in Oregon City, Oregon. And we specialize in people with chronic diseases, but especially people with lung cancer and hepatitis C. We are for this bill. This is a patient-driven bill. I, as an employer in Oregon, purchase insurance for my employees. It is a dread for me to try to have to purchase the right program every time, and it's impossible for me to know what is on those plans unless we have this type of transparency as an employer. I can't sign up for a plan and then find out it doesn't cover something that one of my employees potentially has. I mean, I would basically just ask you, would you buy a car if you didn't know the cost of it or if you didn't know what fuel it needed to run on? This is a basic right that we should have this transparency. And the Dash 1 amendment, I feel, is really important, too, especially for lung cancer patients. Medical switching in the middle of a year can really damage a lung cancer patient. Many of them are on therapies that are just modeled for them. That switching can cost them to interrupt their therapy, and it also can cause them to become resistant to their therapy. So I would just like to say that I support the bill. I think it's straightforward as an employer and as an advocate. I think it makes total sense. So thank you. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Chair Monas-Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, and members of the committee, my name is Christopher Friend. I'm the Government Relations Director for the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. I'm grateful for the privilege to address the committee in support of Senate Bill 272, specifically with the Dash 1 amendment. First, I'd like to mention that this is widely supported by many patient advocacy groups that submitted written testimony, which I will refer you to. For cancer patients, buying a health care plan that covers the drugs that they need at a cost that they can afford has a direct impact on their ability to effectively fight and beat their disease. Even with health insurance, cancer care can be very costly, especially if a patient buys a plan that does not cover the drugs that they need or at a cost that they can afford. And we believe that Senate Bill 272 empowers cancer patients to easily find and compare coverage and cost information across available plans, making them better able to choose coverage that best fits their medication and affordability needs. Based on policy recommendations from the Consumer Advocate Stakeholder Committee of the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, Senate Bill 272 requires insurance carriers to disclose all drugs covered under each health benefit plan, including those drugs administered in a provider's office, typically covered under a plan's medical benefit, as opposed to just prescription drugs. This is especially important for cancer patients whose treatment is frequently infused in a clinic, think chemotherapy. Additionally, the bill requires that health plans disclose dollar cost sharing or dollar range for a patient would pay if their drug was subject to coinsurance, allowing the patient to adequately estimate their monthly out-of-pocket costs. Studies have shown that cancer treatment medications are increasingly being placed on higher tier cost tiers of a formulary and being assigned coinsurance. If a patient knows that their responsibility is 30% of coinsurance, that doesn't give them the actual dollar cost, and thus prohibiting the patient from knowing if they'll be able to afford the dollar cost should they buy that plan. The bill will make sure that patients have an estimated dollar cost information before they buy the plan. This bill, as drafted, allows plans to maintain proprietary information of actual cost while giving patients an estimated range for their responsibility of the drug.
For example, a drug subject to coinsurance would require a dollar sign symbolizing a range of cost, which is, which the patient would be responsible for. $1 sign is a drug less than $100. $2 signs is a drug between $100 and $250, and so on. Additionally, carriers can bypass this whole section by just offering plans that are copay only. This is an important provision which empowers patients to use their comparison shopping for the most cost-effective plans that meets their medical needs. Finally, SB 272 ensures that insurance carriers honor contractual agreements entered into during open enrollment. This legislation would prohibit a carrier from making changes to a drug formulary, which results in a higher cost for patients. That means a drug may not be moved to a higher cost tier or removed from a formulary altogether in the middle of a year. Allow me to be clear. This does not lock carriers into a formulary in an entire year. Quite the contrary. The bill allows carriers to add a drug to the formulary or move a drug to a lower cost tier. For ACS-CAM, this bill is about ensuring contractual obligations that are fulfilled throughout the year. Additionally, I'd like to address that this concept was addressed in the drug pricing work group run by Representative Nose, who instructed legislative counsel to draft this bill. It's widely supported in consensus of that work group, and I'm happy to provide a public record as such. Finally, I just want to say that being treated for cancer is hard. Researching your health plan and purchasing an insurance plan that meets your medication and affordability needs shouldn't be hard. At ACS-CAN, we believe patients should have access to clear and reliable drug coverage when purchasing a plan. And we believe that this bill empowers patients to be smart consumers and ensures that patients are protected by enforcing contractual obligations throughout the plan year. Thank you again for the opportunity to address the committee. ACS-CAN is in support of Senate Bill 272 with the -1 amendment because we know it will have tangible results in assisting patients to research and find the affordability needs for the medications that save their lives. Thank you.
Chair Mona Sanderson, Vice Chair Cruz, and the committee, thank you all for this opportunity to speak with you. I'm here on behalf of the National Multiple Sclerosis Society in support of SB 272. The National MS Society believes the passage of 272 would have a positive and meaningful impact on many Oregonians.
You need to say your name.
Oh, I'm sorry, Dale Turner. I apologize. Why would I forget that? At any rate. MS is an unpredictable and often disabling disease of the central nervous system. MS interferes with the flow of information within the brain and from the brain to the body. It's like an electrical cord for an appliance in your home, for your vacuum cleaner or a fan. If there's a little kink in there and a little short, not only could you zap your fingers, but the message from the plug is not getting to the fan or the appliance. So it's frustrating because your brain is saying, hey, this is what I want to do, and your body's not following the orders. Not fun. At any rate, symptoms of this range from numbness and tingling to blindness and paralysis. The progress, severity, and specific symptoms of MS in any one person cannot be determined in advance, cannot be predicted, and there is currently no cure for MS. Since the disease is not fatal, a person can live with the disease their entire life. For some, it progresses, and they do become severely disabled. For others, the severity is not quite as bad. I was diagnosed in 1995, so for 22 years I've had MS. I just bought this cane 18 months ago. So in the big picture of things, I know that I'm very lucky. I have friends whose first clue they had MS were they couldn't get out of bed in the morning. They couldn't move their legs. That would be a scary thing. For some people, it improved and got worse again, the remitting, relapsing course that it takes. For others, it got worse from there, and that's a sad occurrence. So common symptoms for people with MS include muscle spasticity, which is for me, for instance, is muscle stiffness. It affects gait, affects a number of things, dexterity with the hands and fingers. Fatigue is a major factor, and I'm not talking about sipping a cup of coffee readily fixes. But actual physical fatigue, you have a certain amount of energy for the day, and you deduct your energy balance from that as the day progresses. It doesn't rejuvenate until your body hasn't a chance, a long period to recover. And if you overextend yourself one day, you're taking a deduction from your energy from the next day. It has a long-term effect. So the other issue is balance. For me, it's directly related to fatigue. The more tired I am, the more I rely on this cane just to, if I can be standing there, you all might wonder where I went to lunch today if I didn't have the cane. So it's good to have that. I am most affected, and most people are most affected by these symptoms in terms of walking. For me, typing. I no longer type with my left hand. I use voice recognition software. And my intentions today to have a tie on were thwarted by spasticity in the fingers, not wanting to play nice today. So we just tossed on a sweater instead of tying a tie. I do have one that has elastic, so I can put it on, and it's already tied, and I just elastic, so it still looks like a tie and not one of the clip-ons. But it didn't have that plan today.
So this bill, this particular bill, will there. Actually help.
It will help in that people who people won't have prescriptions changed and taken from the formulary, or the formulary modified so that the out of payment, pocket payment, the copay, or the coinsurance is greater. The transparency is important for patients with MS in terms of being notified of changes and knowing ahead of time what's going to happen. It's like car insurance, middle of the year, you don't want to find out that your car insurance just went up by 40%. Okay, finishing really very quickly. You mentioned a lot of things, but requiring the insurance to post the drug formularies electronically, ensure that they're searchable by name of each drug would make a big difference for people with MS. Would require plans disclose cost sharing that would be paid by the enrollee. And finally, I'd like to just urge the committee's support. It's vital to people with MS that we know what we're getting into when we deal with the drug prices. The current medications start at $66,000 a year, and so just a small increase in copay or coinsurance is a significant thing for people with MS, many of whom are disabled and have limited income. So,
thank you. Questions for this panel? Good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dan Wanser and Chris Bonoff.
While you guys are getting sent, I'm just going to make one comment because I have to leave early for a field trip for another committee. I appreciate the concerns raised by people in this committee. My only concern is that at the moment is that it's a little nebulous and that there's so many other bills that we're considering around pharmacy pricing and consistency and awareness that at some point, Madam Chair, as we hear more of those bills, some of which are mine, I would appreciate that we have a broader conversation all in full soup. It's good to get this information out today, but I'd like this to be considered in the context of other pharmaceutical price control and price awareness bills that we're looking at this session.
And it's my intent to hear all of the pharmacy bills, and then we as a committee will figure out which ones can have a work session. Okay, thank you. Please proceed.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, my name is Chris Bonneff. I'm executive director of the Oregon State Chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We're a membership-governed grassroots organization with 15 chapters across the state of Oregon. We're all people with direct lived experience with mental illness. We're family members, we're parents, we're people who live with illness ourselves. here to speak in favor of the legislation. Describing an annual rite of passage for all of us affected by mental illness, and then as NAMI, we sit down with people and go through this rite of passage every open enrollment period, which is you look at whatever plans are in front of you, and you find out, is your prescriber on there? Is your medication on there? Is your psychotherapist on there? And it's a critical period where we pick plans based on that. And then you begin estimating, what are our costs? What are my medications that I can't live without going to cost me through the year? What is my copay on my therapist? What is it going to cost me to see my prescriber? And you calculate this during a very short period of time, where as a consumer, you're being asked more and more to make informed choices and understand these costs and budget for these things. Why we feel this legislation is important is because all three of those elements, including medications, these are not interchangeable for us. If a medication goes up in cost, you can't switch in the middle of a course of therapy to another antidepressant or another antipsychotic or another anti-anxiety medicine. We have to have what we have to have. And when unpredictability occurs in the middle of a plan year with a significant increase in the cost of access to our therapists, or in this case, a significant increase in the cost of our medications, we face some untenable choices. One is going without. Two is sacrificing other resources, trying to scramble together other resources to be able to pay for your medications. The third is a real human cost, and it involves an association like mine, which is you spend hours and days and weeks jumping through all the many administrative hoops that are put in front of you there to try to deny you access to that medication in the name of cost. And those are our choices. Why we like this legislation as NAMI is that, again, we as consumers, through high deductible plans, through all these various methods, are being asked to take more charge over our health care. I think in return, what we would like from our health care is predictability. When we go through those choices, when we pick our plans, when we pick them for our particular needs, that the rules don't change midway through the game. Again, this isn't to prohibit a plan from ever changing, but I think it's a commitment that an insurance plan needs to make to its members, just in the same way as we are making a commitment to the insurance plan. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Senator Manas Anderson and members of the Senate Committee on Health Care. My name is Dan Wanzer, and I'm an Oregon citizen here to provide testimony in support of Senate Bill 272 and the -1 amendment offered by the American Cancer Society. 11 years ago, in 2006, when I was 49 years old, I got a lucky break. While most people don't think of broken ribs as a lucky break, in my case, they led to an x-ray, which led to the discovery of a spot in my lungs, which turned out to be lung cancer. Not seeing the lucky part yet? Well, at that point, neither was I. I was stunned. My body flushed with adrenaline. My head was spinning with disbelief and thinking about planning my funeral and telling my wife, losing my hair, and wondering how I got it. Lung cancer didn't make any sense. I'm a non-smoking vegetarian who works out at the gym every day. I wasn't a coal miner. I didn't work with asbestos. How could I get lung cancer? I didn't have any other risk factors. With the support of my incredible and loving wife, Genevieve, who is also here today, we gradually got over the shock and started putting one foot in front of the other. I went through chemo and then had surgery to remove one of the lobes of my lungs, and then more chemo. My doctors were doing their best to provide hope, but I had seen the statistics on stage 3 lung cancer. My life expectancy was measured in months. That didn't stop me from doing everything within my power to stay alive. I continued working out at the gym every day, even during chemo. I ate healthy and got lots of sleep. I leaned heavily on Genevieve's love and support, and friends and family stepped up in ways that I never expected. And along the way, I learned that about 18% of lung cancers are among non-smokers. Lung cancer could happen to anyone. It could be you or someone you love. Even if you're doing all the right things. Although this was the same old chemo that had been around for decades, and it had nasty side effects and a very low success rate. It was the only option available at the time, and it was generic. I was extremely fortunate that we caught the cancer early enough because of my lucky break, and that it was effective for me, and that I didn't have to worry about whether it was in my insurance formulary. Every 3 months, I had another CAT scan. We in the cancer community have a name for that time leading up to a scan. We call it scanxiety. Genevieve and I had plenty of sleepless nights leading up to those scans. But with each passing scan showing no evidence of cancer, our level of fear dropped just a little bit. We knew that 5 years was the magic milepost where the chances of recurrence dropped significantly. I couldn't wait to get to 5 years. But a few months before reaching that invisible safe zone, a scan showed thousands of spots on my lungs. Those spots turned out to be stage 4 lung cancer. If it's possible, we were even more devastated this time around. The other word for stage 4 is terminal. Still, we didn't give up. I went through chemo again. I continued eating well and getting lots of sleep and exercising, even though my body felt like crap from the chemo. After chemo, I went on a brand new long-term chemo maintenance drug. Eventually, it caused kidney damage, so I had to discontinue. Still, it had done its job. It stopped the cancer in its tracks for another 18 months. The name of the game in cancer survival is to buy more time and hope that another new treatment comes along the way when you need it. That's exactly what happened for me. My cancer had a genetic mutation that could be treated with a next-generation targeted genetic treatment. This targeted therapy came on the market in 2011, right when I was diagnosed the second time at age 54. How lucky can one guy be? Very lucky, as it turns out. I squeezed another 16 months out of this treatment before my cancer started to mutate. I was able to afford this treatment because of another lucky break, insurance that I could count on. That was just long enough for a new clinical trial to come out for a targeted therapy for this new mutation. I became one of 344 people in the world in this trial, and I got on just days before it closed. Yet another lucky break. However, there was one small catch. This clinical trial was in San Diego. Genevieve and I made 14 trips to San Diego in the first 8 months and have gone once every 6 weeks since. When your life is on the line, is there any question about whether it's worth it, even with travel expenses that are this draining? This new drug, expected to work for 13 months, has now been working for me for 28 months. Since there is no new treatment in sight, I treasure every day that this medication is extending my life and continue to hope that the next lucky break will come my way when I need it. However, these therapies cost a minimum of $6,000 to $9,000 per month, and there's more. After cancer ate away at my hips and spine, I also took a bone strengthening injection at a cost of roughly $5,000 a month. Adding CAT scans, radiation treatment, frequent lab work, doctor's visits, then consider that many people who need this treatment are unable to work due to their illness. You can see how your life depends on knowing what your insurance coverage is and knowing that it will continue covering what you plan for it to cover. Starting with my ribs, every break has gone my way. New treatments have come along right when I needed them. Family and friends have supported me, and I have done everything within my own power to stay alive. I've come to believe it takes a village to shrink a tumor. The last piece of this village is insurance. If I didn't have insurance coverage that I could depend on, I would have to choose between bankrupting my family or refusing treatment. Nobody should have to make that choice. One fellow survivor told me that her cancer medication cost nearly $180,000 a year. There are no substitutes for this therapy targeted to her specific mutation. If she couldn't count on her insurance, she would have been dead years ago. Another survivor told me that after working for 40 years, cancer disabled her. Yet she is paying for three different insurances because any surprises in her insurance bill would put this treatment out of reach. These are choices we should not have to make. This is why I urge Oregon legislators to support passage of this important consumer protection legislation. Consumer laws provide safe home mortgage practices, and yet we must make treatment decisions equivalent to a mortgage with no information about the cost. At this time, it is apparently not a breach of contract for the insurance company to substantially increase my copay when I am locked into their coverage, or even to stop covering the medication I depend on for my very life. I've had more than my share of lucky breaks, but I don't want to have to rely on an insurance company to be one of them. Please support Senate Bill 272 and the -1 amendment offered by the American Cancer Society. Okay. Do you have any questions for me?
Thank you so much for your testimony. Questions? Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Elizabeth Ramley, Jessica Adamson, and Inga Deckert.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson here with Providence Health and Services. I want to thank this committee for the opportunity to describe why we are opposed to this bill as it's written, and the need for, as Senator Steiner Hayward referenced, looking at all of these bills dealing with drug pricing, transparency, and cost together. Providence, it's myself, as well as others on this panel, were active participants in the interim drug pricing work group. That work group looked at a broad range of ideas. As was noted, these ideas were among those presented. I want to be very clear for the record, Providence did not, would not, will not support pieces as a standalone. So this concept presented as a standalone, we did not support that as a standalone item. We are very much concerned about costs and access for consumers. As providers, including at the Providence Cancer Center, where we work every day to find treatments for rare cancers and to be able to get people well and the development of new drugs, we want our patients to have access. Whether it's routine or complex, we need our patients to take their medications. We need folks to stay well. And being able to afford access to that treatment is a high priority for us. However, this problem is complex. The issue of affordability and costs and insurance as it relates to prescription drugs, both delivered through the pharmacy benefit as well as the medical benefit, it is not a one slice of the pie solution. Often in this environment, we've kind of taken at, is it a problem with the insurance company? Is it a problem with the provider? Is it the problem with the consumer? Is it a problem with the drug company? The answer is, it's all of the above. We can no longer look at this issue, which is very complex, as a, well, we can fix it if we just get after the insurance companies, or we can fix it if we just get after the drug companies, or we can fix it if we dot, dot, dot. It's going to take a comprehensive solution. This work group that met 9 months for 4 hours at a time, it was a lot of great bonding experience with many in this room, looked at proposals with the three-part lens. The first question was whether or not any proposal that came forward would help consumers afford their medications. The second question was about whether or not it would cause an increase in premium rates. And then the third question was whether or not it would address or slow down the increasing costs of prescription drugs. And what ultimately, I can tell you, Providence, and I think others on this panel would say, is that we needed to look at something that did all three. So looking at increased transparency, looking at how do we ensure fair pricing of prescription drugs, and how do we help consumers access those drugs more predictably and affordably than they're able to do today. And when combined all together, you're able to look at a package that would then help manage the costs of being able to do this. As it's written, Senate Bill 272 would create a massive new increased cost to insurers. The technology that's required as part of this legislation does not exist today. We would have to build it, and that would not come cheap, nor would it come quickly. So the way it's written today with an implementation of 1-1 of 18, there's no way that we could be ready to do this in the timeline that folks would like us to. And the cost wouldn't be offset with any savings, wouldn't be offset with any predictability on the increasing price of drugs, which in many ways at its heart is the problem here. The increasing cost of drugs in an unaccountable way to the public has a real and dramatic impact on our consumers. When we have no control over what those costs are, they cannot be managed by providers or patients, what we end up with is a situation where the increasing cost to consumers are driven by folks that are thousands of miles away making decisions in a vacuum without transparency. We'll tell you that how we work on our formularies is a scientific-driven process. We have P&T committees that meet. I believe ours meet at least quarterly. They look at the formulary. They look at what drugs have come out onto the market. They look at whether there are generics. And first, we start with efficacy. What does the science tell us about the performance of any given drug? And how does that drug provide better or less effective results than what's currently on the formulary? And how can we ensure that patients have access to drugs? We do not change our formularies on a lark. Those are very, very carefully balanced decisions that start first with what does the clinical evidence tell us. And if the clinical evidence is telling us that a generic drug that is equally as effective as a brand name drug comes onto the market mid-year, we are going to likely move to preference for that generic drug and not so preferential treatment for the name brand drug. Those are, for example, the kinds of changes that happen mid-year in an effort to control costs for consumers and ensure broader access to drugs. This is not a situation in which we're just willy-nilly moving stuff up and down the formulary, taking drugs on and off the formulary. That creates disruption for consumers, and believe me, we hear about it from our members. If we're moving things around, we hear it from our members and we hear it from our providers. And as a population health entity, there is a lot of conversation that happens between our doctors and our plan about how do we provide consistency, how do we make sure that our patients stay well. Again, we look at this bill as a small piece of what needs to be a comprehensive solution, and if passed on its own, wouldn't begin to address the larger problems that exist in the system today. We would urge this committee to continue its work in looking at all of the bills, in particular the many that are currently sitting in the House Healthcare Committee, to examine them as a group and to move forward with a single comprehensive package in a single bill that rises and falls all together. Thank you. Apologize for the length and happy to answer any questions.
Finish the panel first.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Inga Deckert here for Kaiser Permanente. And we wholeheartedly agree with everything that Jessica just said. There also is a letter that's been submitted for the record that goes into a little bit of detail about the concerns with implementing the bill, just the practicality and the challenges of doing that. And the only thing really that I'd like to add is, in some of the testimony that we just heard previously, an example was given about, you wouldn't want to go buy a car or agree to buy a car if you didn't know the price. And I think carriers share some of the same frustrations that we just heard from those who testified earlier. We don't have stability or predictability with respect to drug prices in a plan year. They're increased on us at a moment's notice or with no notice, and they can be increased multiple times during the year. So I think we're all sort of frustrated with that same situation and not being able to plan as well as we'd like to, and having a situation that we may begin a year with change on us throughout that year, all of that lends itself to us. It's challenging for all of us to be able to afford the medications, both for enrollees and for the carriers, to afford these medications given their pricing structure and the fact that prices keep increasing the way they do.
But if you have a contract with a manufacturer, they can raise their prices. You can't designate in your contract with a manufacturer for a set period of time that it will be this particular price?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, so I asked that question of Kaiser, and I'm still getting more information, but some of the initial information that I received was that especially for these specialty high-priced drugs, our contracts are on a percentage of the wholesale acquisition cost, and those increase. And so as those increase, our prices increase.
Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, Elizabeth Remley sitting here this time for Cambia Health Solutions, which is an umbrella group that both includes insurance plans under the Regions Blue Cross Blue Shield brand and the Bridgespan brand, but also a range of health IT startups, including one that they're very proud of that launched in January, which is called MedSavvy, and it's a transparency product, and it's being used across the country. Tom Holt told me this morning that something like 70 million eyeballs are on it and people are using it. MedSavvy helps folks figure out exactly these kinds of questions that we're asking. What's in the formulary? How much is it going to cost me out of pocket? That kind of thing, to help folks pick their plans. Cambia takes a backseat to no one on transparency and the tools that are available on the web and in other places to help folks pick their plans and do the right thing when it comes to choosing health insurance. The bill mandates transparency in a way that we think actually will stifle innovation in the transparency world, especially around the new health IT products that are coming out. We have pretty big concerns about that. If transparency becomes a compliance requirement rather than something geared at making sure that consumers know exactly what they're doing when they're choosing health plans and making decisions about their health care, that presents a problem for us, and we don't want to do it that way. In addition, I want to echo what both Jessica and Inga have said about the full suite of drug bills that are out this session. Cambia was the third member from the health insurance world that was on that committee. We also don't remember committing to doing any of these bills in a one-off form. We talked about putting together a package. We have to put together a package because, as Inga and Jessica have both pointed out, the blame on this stuff does not rest with one industry group. It goes up the chain all the way to the folks who are initially selling products into the system. We have to figure this out. So we encourage the committee to examine everything that's being brought forward this session and make a decision about a robust policy around drug prices and what Oregon can do to solve the problem.
Questions for the panel? Thank you very much. BJ Kavnor and Jesse O'Brien.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is BJ Kavnor. I serve as Executive Director for 1 in 4 Chronic Health. We are Oregon's Chronic Health Care and Chronic Disease Coalition. Very simply, This bill makes sense. This bill makes such good sense for patients that I can't believe that we have to make a law or we have to pass a law to make this available. I was also one of the members of the committee that was formed by Representatives Greenlick and Nose, speaking on behalf of patients. And my colleague Jesse and I sat next to each other and passed notes. We were very good. This was one of the things that we had requested. By we, I mean patient groups. Moving forward, this was one of the issues that we requested. And if one looks back in the records and in the writing and in the videotapes, you will see this. This was an ask of the insurance providers to have a basic level of transparency made available so consumers could make better decisions around plans for themselves. In fact, we all referred to this as the Medicare model, which if you've ever had to use Medicare or help someone sign up for Medicare, you know that the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services offers an online database that where you enter your medications, it will help you decide the best plan for you. So this is not great technology that doesn't exist. I would, however, like to address some of the issues that were raised by the last speakers briefly, if I might. With regard to the technology being impossible and unavailable, I had the privilege of serving up until 2011 December as the co-chair of HITOC, the Health Information Technology Oversight Committee. And this was a very big, important issue with us because we understood that as we're trying to build an electronic health record for all systems and all patients in Oregon, we were trying to do this in compliance with federal law and moving forward, we talked about these issues. And so this is not an impossible thing. In fact, this is nothing more than a great database. I find it very, very difficult and disingenuous, frankly, to hear language that's coming from insurance providers and even certain members of the legislature who are questioning whether or not this is something that is in the best interests of patients. We see a lot of bills that are dealing with health care, and there are a number of them, and I greatly support that we would come and revisit this and look at the apples to apples and make comparisons moving on. But these bills are not backed by patient groups. These bills are not backed by pharmaceutical companies. These bills are backed by insurance companies. And I don't see how not having transparency and not guaranteeing me or the gentleman who spoke access to medication that they depend on to stay healthy within a one-year plan of an insurance contract is going to hurt the bottom line of an insurance company. I just find that very difficult to believe when you look at the top five insurance companies nationwide last year made more than $105 billion in profits. This bill is fair, quite simply. Our opposition is talking about truth and fairness. Well, here's the truth and here's the fairness. This bill is fair for patients. And if insurance companies are demanding transparency of everybody else involved in healthcare, why is it not fair that we ask some transparency of them? Thank you very much, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Just one question.
Yes,
don't
ma'am.
You think it goes both ways, transparency, insurance companies, transparency, manufacturers of the drugs?
I do indeed, and I think that transparency only works when it involves everyone. However, as the people who wrote the bill with AHIP, the American Health Insurance Association, who worked with members in crafting the bill and the organization,
which
very
bill?
Well.
This bill?
No, not this bill. The larger 2387, the product of the work group, are very well aware that there are federal laws in place. And that particular bill, if passed as is, would violate certain federal laws, and that would be problematic. And besides of which, none of these bills have any direct impact on lowering the cost of medication. This is placing the blame. We all understand how healthcare costs go. We all understand that it's not as simple as blaming one party or the other, that there are a number of things in here, including personal responsibility that we take in our own lives to maintain our health. And this is not a simple solution. And so it's very distressing to find this coming down to sound bites. Thank you.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jesse O'Brien. I am the policy director for OSPIRG, which is the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, a statewide consumer advocacy group. And we are here in support of this legislation, although I would like to clarify that we are agnostic as to whether this policy move forward as a standalone bill or as part of a larger package. We would love to see a larger package that addresses the issue of rising prescription drug costs in a comprehensive way. And we are urging the legislature to make that a top priority for this legislative session. But I do want to speak today briefly in favor of this specific concept, because I think that this set of policies, especially as amended with the Dash 1 amendments, will enable consumers to better navigate their health plan's prescription drug benefit, to be more empowered and informed shoppers for health coverage, and provide peace of mind that the pharmacy benefits purchased at enrollment are not going to be revoked mid-year. I think consumers expect reasonably that when they enter into an agreement to pay a premium to a health insurance company, that agreement goes both ways and they can count on access to the benefits that they purchased. But if insurers drop coverage or substantially increase out-of-pocket costs for specific drugs mid-year, Oregon consumers currently have little to no recourse. And if those changes happen outside of the annual open enrollment period, consumers may not even be able to switch coverage to another plan that might cover those drugs, in which case they may be forced to pay the entire cost out of pocket or go without needed medicine. And although these kinds of mid-year changes do not necessarily affect a large number of Oregonians, we just think that nobody in Oregon should be vulnerable to losing access to the drugs they need when they've paid premiums with the, I think, very reasonable expectation that those medications will be covered by their health plan. My understanding is that the Dash 1 amendments will clarify, first of all, importantly, that the legislation won't block insurers from adding new drugs to formularies mid-year, and secondly, that insurers will be able to raise out-of-pocket costs for a brand-name drug when a generic equivalent becomes available, which I think is entirely appropriate. And, in fact, we would be inclined not to support this if it did not include that, because we think it's appropriate for insurers to encourage the use of generic medications in that way. And I'll just say, you know, in the coming weeks, the legislature is going to be considering a range of policy options, including House Bill 2387, which was mentioned before, to contain prescription drug costs, increase transparency and accountability for prescription drug manufacturers. We think that should be a top priority. And I will just gently correct my colleague to the left here and say that there are some consumer and patient groups that support those package of bills, including OSPIRG. I think those bills are going to take some work, but we are supportive of the direction they go in. Like I said, we urge you to make this a top priority this legislative session. Oregon consumers are deeply concerned about the rising cost of prescription drugs. But while that overall package of bills and the subject of rising prescription drugs is highly controversial, we think this set of policies really shouldn't be. We think this is a modest, common-sense consumer protection measure, and we would urge your support. Thank you.
Can I state for the record, Madam Chair, one more thing? Thank you for the recognition. Good people can disagree and agree on things. Out of just a question to the insurance companies, when we spoke of this, and this was spoken of, correct me if I'm wrong, during the work groups, transparency for accountability for drug companies, why didn't the drug companies perhaps come forth with something of their own that would have or met us halfway to talk about working on something like this? It just confuses me. And frankly, it's unfortunate that the people who are responsible for helping pay so much of our health care costs are our adversaries at this issue. That's truly unfortunate. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And when I do talk with the drug companies, and there are some out there in the audience, I say that this is a problem that everyone has to help with and to come forward with ideas. And I would agree with you that that there hasn't been, I feel good, well, I think there's been good faith effort, but I think there could be a whole lot more effort on both sides in trying to reach a consensus bill that would really help patients, and that's what I'm most interested in.
Madam Chair, with what the uncertainty of what's going on at the federal level, I think it's incumbent upon us to make certain that we can do the best in the interest of Oregonians to have the protections and the provisions in place to help manage these things, at least at the state level. It's just common sense, and I agree with you, ma'am. We do all have to come together and work on this, and I had hoped for greater outcomes from the work group, but at least I got to know some of my colleagues better.
Well, we still have some good bills coming forward, and I like Senator Steiner Hayward's idea of having them all together and looking at all of them in the context and what is going to help the industry, and I mean the healthcare industry, which includes consumers, mm-hmm. Which can be doable. Thanks.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
Any other comments? I see no one else listed. We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 272. Any comments? We are adjourned. Any comments? We are adjourned.